From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Ahead of what would have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 90th birthday, there are the obligatory memorials and retrospectives remembering his critical work on civil rights. But near the end of his short life, Dr. King took on the project of economic inequality and addressing it, and led the Poor People's Campaign. There's always been a racial wealth gap in the US, but that gap has not closed. In fact, since the 1980s, it has doubled. A new report by the Institute for Policy Studies, titled Dreams Deferred, has found that between 1983 and 2016, the median Black family saw their wealth drop by more than half after inflation, compared to a 33% increase for the median white household. Meanwhile, the number of households with $10 million or more skyrocketed by 856%. The report links the ever-rising fortunes of the wealthy with the ongoing racial wealth gap. Joining me to discuss the report is Diedrich Asante Muhammad. He is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and he's also a co-author of the report, whose full title is Dreams Deferred: How Enriching the 1% Widens the Racial Wealth Divide. Welcome to the program, Diedrich.
And thank you for having me.
So the numbers are pretty grim. We've always known there is a racial wealth gap, but to actually see the details of it is startling, and it hasn't seemed to have gotten much better. Can you give us a summary of what are some of the statistics that for you best characterize how there's this ongoing racial wealth gap in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think even before I get into the kind of racial wealth divide, I just would like to highlight, you know, the importance of racial economic inequality as a whole and why we released this on Martin Luther King's birthday. I mean, as you mentioned, Dr. King's last campaign was the Poor People's Campaign. And the Poor People's Campaign clearly is a focus on alleviating poverty, dealing with those issues, but also he had a broader focus around economics. In 66, he signed on to the Freedom Budget, which is something that the NAACP, the Urban League, even radicals like Stokely Carmichael had signed on to, saying this is what the American budget would have to look like in order to actually redress racial inequality. You know, I think oftentimes when we talk about racial inequality, we get caught up in personal relations. But I think there was in the past a clearer understanding that it was the material relations which has really been the context of racial inequality, and that we'd have to change the economy of the country in order to address that. And I think for the last 50 or so years since King's death, we've seen that the country hasn't been willing to address racial economic inequality. And in particular, we're highlighting how wealth is a signifier of the deep inequality that still exists in this country economically.
One of the markers of wealth, of course, is home ownership. How specifically on the issue of home ownership do we see a difference within or between racial groups?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen home ownership go up over the last 30 so years, even after the Great Recession and the foreclosure crisis. We've seen that go up for whites. Whites used to have a home ownership rate around 60-something percent, and now it's up to 71%. Black home ownership rates have really stayed around from the last 30 or so years, around 44%, and Latinos have seen their home ownership rates rise, but up to about, 44-45% today. So we see a huge disparity in terms of home ownership rates, 44-46% to 71%. But even that doesn't capture everything, because the median home value for Blacks and Latinos, even if you are a homeowner, can oftentimes only be about 50% that of whites. So even when you own a home, it's valued much less than the median property value for a white home.
If things continue at their current rate and there is no actual policy taken on by the government to reduce the racial wealth divide, how would things project in the future? What would doing nothing do?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point, because, again, you know, oftentimes when we talk about race, people want to say, well, we're not where we want to be, but we're headed in the right direction. But when you look at the economics, when you look at economic numbers, when you look at wealth numbers, you can see that we're not even headed in the right direction. Again, as you alluded to, The median wealth of whites today is 147,000 in 2016. That's the most recent numbers we have. And that's going up from around 110,000 in 1983. Black wealth is around 3,600. And that's a decrease from a little over 6,000 in 1983. And
Latino wealth has gone. When you say wealth, you're not talking about income. You're talking about sort of assets and how much a household is worth.
Absolutely. I mean, income.
And you said only $3,600.
$3,600 median wealth. That's your assets. We don't include things like cars and these types of things, but it does include your pension. It does include any profit you have in your home. It includes all those things, minus your debts. And again, that shows, Latino wealth has gone up a bit, but Latino wealth is only around $6,000. So you have $6,000, and let's just round up, around $4,000 for blacks compared to almost $150,000 median wealth for whites. So you see, you're talking about income. Blacks and Latinos make somewhere between 60 cents to 65 cents on every dollar of income that whites make. But in terms of wealth, blacks and Latinos only have, two or 3 cents on every dollar of wealth that whites make. So you see the disparity is that much greater.
Now, Diedrich, you do hear elites protecting wealthy Americans talking about the racial wealth gap as something to take on. But often you hear this idea of rising tide lifts all boats. How diverse are the wealthiest American households?
Sure. Well, if we look at the Fortune 400, which is a commonly used parameter of looking at the wealthiest people in the country, we see that out of 400, there are two blacks that make it into the Fortune 400. And you see there's only four Latinos that make it into the Fortune 400. You have to be about a little bit over $2 billion to get into the Fortune 400. And of those four Latinos, two of them are brothers who are sons of a billionaire out of Colombia. So you can see Colombia, South America. So you can see that there's, a huge disparity. I mean, two out of 400, it's not even, it's like 0.5% of the, and blacks are 13% of the population. Latinos are about similar. So you see there's a huge disparity even in the wealthiest Americans. And again, you can look at these median wealth numbers and you can see, and we've seen in other reports, that even higher income blacks have radically less wealth than whites of much lower income. Because again, wealth is something that you don't just get from a paycheck. It's something you build up over time. It's something that usually, kind of stems from generational wealth. And I think, the greatest challenge around racial wealth inequality isn't that an individual household is in asset or wealth poverty. It's that their entire community, the entire social network is in asset poverty. So even if you are making good money for the first time or the first generation to do so, you're usually helping your community, your family, secure themselves financially versus investing to allow for greater returns of wealth.
Right. So inherited wealth is a very important source of wealth building. And we've had numerous efforts, many successful, to tax inherited wealth less and less, which, of course, keeps the wealth in those families that have already had it for a very long time. Now, your report links the concentration of wealth at the top, the 1%, to the broader wealth divide between racial groups. Can you draw that connection, make the links for us? Why increasingly concentrated wealth of the type that the Koch brothers and Jeff Bezos have is linked to the stagnation of wealth among non-white communities?
Sure. I mean, I think it's important to understand that even, whites developing what I'll call middle class wealth, let's say, somewhere, $80,000 of median wealth to around $200,000 median wealth. This didn't just happen. This didn't just happen by people, working hard and saving. People do work hard and save, but it also happened through, massive investments into creating an American middle class, right? This happened with kind of the development of the social safety net after the Great Depression. It happened after World War II with the GI Bill, with mass government subsidies on home ownership, mass government subsidies on housing and road building, and even government subsidies and employment. And this allowed for, and actually a very, very progressive tax system. Whereas the Congresswoman out of New York has noted, you know, we
had Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes, I always mix up her name, but that's right. As she noted, even as up to about 1980, we had the high marginal tax rate at 70%. So those who made over a certain amount of money were paying taxes of 70%, anything above that number. We've had a much more regressive tax system and a much more regressive economy, whereas we've seen that where the wealth has gone, it is mostly going to at levels of over 90% to the wealthiest Americans. And so even as the economy grows, most Americans aren't getting that growth, aren't getting that stability. And, you know, most in particular, Blacks and Latinos who've never been a part of the great American middle class, particularly in terms of wealth. Let's not look at income, let's look at wealth, have never had that strong wealth stability, have been left economically insecure. So it's kind of a contradiction in that as there is more and more civil rights and less outright legal racial prejudice, you would think that then everyone would be able to move forward economically. But as we've had that happening, we've had at the same time a much more regressive economy, making it much more difficult for people to move forward economically, which again, I think is the basis of equality in this country and has been the basis of racial inequality in this country.
Let's turn to what some of the report's recommendations are to address this. But I'm glad you brought up Ocasio-Cortez, because this is now becoming finally an important political point with some of these newly elected members of Congress bringing it up. Because unfortunately, far too often, establishment Democrats have been quite happy to let Wall Street keep being Wall Street. Former Republican Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin tweeted, explaining tax rates before Reagan to fifth graders. Imagine if you did chores for your grandma and she gave you $10. When you got home, your parents took $7 from you. The student said, that's not fair. Even fifth graders get it. And Diedrich, this has often been the way in which Republicans and conservatives who've defended enriching the already wealthy have explained it. It's just about fairness. And then you had Ocasio-Cortez, I think, give such an effective response to Walker. She said, explaining marginal taxes to a far-right former governor. Imagine if you did chores for Abuela and she gave you $10. When you got home, you got to keep it because it's only $10. Then we taxed the billionaire in town because he's making tons of money underpaying the townspeople. She's suggested a 70% tax rate on the wealthiest Americans to fund a Green New Deal. And it turns out that is highly popular. There was a new poll showing that a majority of Americans, including Republicans, something like 60% of the public, supports a 70% tax rate on the wealthy. But even a 70% tax rate isn't that radical, right?
No, I mean, that was radical. It'd be like something we've never done before. Like, we did that. Like, that was normal for quite a while in this country, you know. And I think, you know, since the Great Recession, it was really clear that the people weren't going to get bailed out. It was only the banks. I think there's been a more clear understanding that wealth in this country has been concentrating at its top. Even, working class people who consider themselves more conservative, more right wing, has recognized that the government has to come in and help distribute wealth and resources in a way that can build the country up as a whole instead of distributed as we do now to concentrate in the wealthiest hands.
A big part of the problem, of course, is that with an increasingly diverse nation, a majority-minority nation, as some have put it, as it's going to be very shortly, for some white Americans, equality feels like oppression. And we, you know, have elections and electoral campaigns run on such a notion that unfortunately have resulted in the way in our current political system. But what are some specific things that the report suggests need to be done in order to address the racial wealth gap? Because clearly things can't be allowed to continue on their current path, because without some government intervention, that racial wealth gap would only keep widening.
No, that's right. And two, I mean, there's government intervention now, right?
Yes, exactly.
Government intervention isn't just raising tax rates, it's also cutting tax rates, right? Or giving government write-offs to different types of corporations. So it's changing the type of intervention and intervening for, you know, the middle class and for working class people versus high income people. And as you noted before, we're in a place where we're showing that, you know, Black wealth is on the decline. Latino wealth is moving up just a little bit, while white wealth is, you know, moving up at over 30% right now. But if you look at, you know, even among whites, it's only the wealthiest whites who are getting the largest part. So there are different types of interventions that need to be put forward. And I think the most exciting thing about today right now is that there's actually some really progressive policies out there being put forward to deal with some of these issues. So one thing that's being widely discussed is something that comes out of some friends of Sandy Darity, Derek Hamilton, have been writing these proposals around baby ponds. Some people might have heard of children's savings accounts, but these kind of large scale, where the idea that every person born will be allocated a certain amount of money, $40,000, $50,000, $20,000, depends on the scale, that is then set aside, grows, and is invested. And so that when they become 18 or 21 or 25, whatever the age level is, they actually will then receive a dividend in capital and have some funds and wealth to help you know, start their lives and invest further education, training, home ownership, these types of things.
Right. We were just discussing this with Robert Friedman, author of a new book called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. And he takes on this exact idea of a baby bond. What else needs to happen? Obviously, we need to change our tax system and make it, you know, transform it from this regressive system that it's turned into back into a more progressive system, right? But we also need to do it in a way that actually reduces the racial wealth gap, not just inequality between rich and poor.
No, that's right. And, you know, one thing we recommend is doing a, you know, racial economic or racial wealth audit on all federal policies. And so we can actually look at a policy and say, you know, and do some analysis about, well, do we think this policy will help bridge racial wealth inequality? Will it maintain it? Will it make it worse? Thomas Shapiro, a great author, activist, scholar around racial economic inequality, you know, did an analysis of if we got rid of student debt for everyone, would that, you know, bridge racial wealth inequality? A lot of people like that idea generally. But he noted that actually that would probably strengthen racial wealth inequality. Whites would disproportionately benefit. But then he, you know, looked at if you got rid of student debt for those households making $50,000 or less, or youth coming from those households making $50,000 or debt or less, it's actually a much less expensive program and one that targets much more working class as well as low wealth households and people of color. It would actually help bridge racial wealth inequality. So I think, you know, an analysis, because, you know, just having these great progressive policy ideas, if we don't do an analysis of actually how that will affect Americans and break it out racially, we don't really know how it affects racial economic inequality or the racial wealth divide in particular.
Now, what about the kinds of conversations, I think, that need to be happening to put forward some of these issues? Because I feel like we're almost there, but not quite there culturally, sort of in the culture of the United States. We're definitely at a point where we can start talking about reducing the wealth gap between rich and poor. But the idea of reducing the racial wealth gap still, unfortunately, remains this difficult issue to tangle out, because, you know, some whites just don't like the idea of doing something about the fact that Black and brown folks are far poorer.
Yeah, no, again, I'll go back to Dr. King. You know, Dr. King was really clear that the issue wasn't that we didn't have the resources to address racial inequality. And he was talking about racial economic inequality. He had pointed out that the problem was we had a lack of will. And that is what we've had for the last 40, 50 years. You know, hopefully the will is changing. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that it might begin to change, even if it's not some type of giving, trying to help others, is we've noted in this report that the median wealth for all Americans has actually decreased since 1983 to 2016 by a few thousand dollars, going down from around a little over $83,000 to about $81,000. And, you know, this decrease I would point to is really coming from the growth of the Black and Latino population, right? Because again, right, median wealth for whites in 1983 was, you know, a little over 100,000. So it was above the national median and continued to grow to almost 150,000 by 2013. It's, you know, Latinos, even with their growth in wealth, is only going up to, you know, a little over $6,000, and Blacks are $3,000. So what we're seeing is that this racial wealth divide is helping to actually weaken the median wealth of America as a whole. And, you know, so it's not just a problem of these communities. It's a problem that it's increasingly going to be, if we don't address racial wealth inequality, we are no longer going to have an economy that is at its foundation an American middle class economy. We're going to have most of the country very economically insecure, wealth poor, and that's a very different America than most people like to imagine.
What about, specifically for African Americans, the idea of reparations?
Oh, definitely. You know, we definitely highlight in the report, there is Congressman Conyers in the past, and now Sheila Jackson Lee has been putting forward legislation to actually just investigate what it would really mean to, you know, to start developing ideas of reparations, you know, for African Americans in particular. So, and in my mind, actually, I mean, addressing racial wealth divide, you know, this is, in a large sense, dealing with reparations, meaning we have to repair, you know, the damage that has occurred to communities, right? And again, racial wealth divide, this country was founded on a racial wealth divide, right? This country was founded on taking the wealth of indigenous people, which is their land, and giving it to European people. It was founded on making people, African people, into the wealth of European people, you know, and it was a solid foundation of our economy. This country is founded on the racial wealth divide. We have to repair that. We should have focused programs looking at what reparations would mean for African Americans, indigenous peoples, what have you. And then we also need some, you know, large federal programs that will deal with, you know, the kind of unstable economy that is occurring for more and more Americans that might not go into the reparations framework, but is still working toward that goal of strengthening the American economy for all its people and for the first time, including African Americans, indigenous people, people of color as a whole. And I think we'll continue to make sure that white Americans don't backslide into the massive economic insecurity that's faced by so many African Americans and indigenous people.
Right. You and I began by talking about home ownership. Does the report also specifically address increasing home ownership among those communities that, you know, still have only a minority able to afford it, purchasing a home?
Yeah, no, it, you know, it highlights Elizabeth Warren has had a pretty far-reaching program that many people think would have particularly good effects in the African-American Latino community to make home ownership, again, something that, you know, most Americans could be involved in. Again, whites didn't become majority homeowners until there was mass federal subsidies and programs to encourage and to help whites become majority homeowners. Blacks and Latinos, of course, weren't allowed to participate at that time in those types of programs. We need that type of program so we can have, for the new 21st century America, we can actually have majority homeownership amongst all communities, something that Blacks and Latinos have never had in this country.
Diedrich, where can people get a hold of the report?
Yes, they can go to inequality.org and find our report, Dreams Deferred. They can go to, we have inequality.org has a Facebook page, and I have a Facebook page called Bridging the Racial Wealth Divide, where people could also find that report and other information about racial wealth inequality. And as well, I do a podcast called Race and Wealth, where we interview various people like Derek Hamilton, like Bob Friedman, who you had introduced, and Thomas Shapiro and others around race and economic inequality if people want more information.
Great. Well, we link to inequality.org from our website. Diedrich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Diedrich Asante Muhammad is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the report he co-authored. It's called Dreams Deferred. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.